Okay, since acute heart failure, we just heard, is a multidisciplinary approach. It's my pleasure to ask Frank Peacock, who is a Cleveland switch to Texas. We are going to talk about Pronto. Thank you, Frank. Without Texan accent, please.
Not yet. I'd like to say thank you to Dr. O'Connor and Dr. Mabaza for the opportunity to present this. The Pronto study is probably one of the easiest studies that you can imagine. We had designed it in the way we've been talking about all morning, and I'll show it to you if I can get the slides to advance. And there are my disclosures. They're mostly for doing research. So everybody knows heart failure is evil, and when they show up in the emergency department, about half of them will have defined hypertension in association with that. The agents we have right now for hypertension aren't so good. We can use nitroglycerin. It's probably the number one used agent. It's not very effective, and it's difficult to titrate. And as you all have seen in the major trials, and Dr. Claylin pointed out a minute ago, we don't really have that much proof that it even works. But it's probably the number one used drug, at least in the U.S. You can use nicardipine. It's slow. And if you get in trouble, you stay in trouble for a long time. Hydralazine, same problem, and it causes reflex tachycardia, and I've seen a number of patients infarct in front of my eyes after that, because you never know their coronary artery status at the time of presentation. Nitroprusside you can use. It's a great drug. It works. It'll bring down the pressure, and it guarantees you an ICU admission. And my hospital, like almost every hospital I've ever heard of, does not have an unlimited supply of ICU beds, so this is hotel and resource management issues. So we designed a trial using clavitipine as an antihypertensive agent. It's a L-type calcium channel blocker. It has a half-life of 1 minute, and it's eaten by the blood. It's metabolized by esterases in the blood, so it's very easy to titrate. It has no inotropic or chronotropic effect. It doesn't do coronary steel, and it's a very effective agent to lower blood pressure with. So Pronto, it was an open-label randomized trial versus standard care. It was not blinded. Clavitipine is very difficult to blind. It looks like milk. It's white. It has a clinical effect that is in 60 seconds. And so it becomes clinically obvious, even if it was blind, that you just use an agent that worked really well. So it's an open-label trial. To get in the trial, you had to have a blood pressure greater than 160. And the primary endpoint is to achieve the target blood pressure. And the physician had to determine what the target blood pressure was ahead of time. And then the patient's endpoint was to get into that range the physician pre-specified, and there had to be at least a 15% reduction in the blood pressure. We had a number of secondary issues or endpoints, and we'll go through those later. One of the things we wanted to do is make the earliest enrolling heart failure trial that had ever been done. And to do that, as the guy from Denmark said, it better be easy, because if there's a lot of hoops, you can't enroll. And so to get into this trial, you had to have a blood pressure greater than 160 and a dyspnea score from 1 to 100 of greater than 50. So these tend to be sick people. They can be difficult to consent because they're so short of breath. They were allowed to receive a non-IV antihypertensive. In other words, nitropace was fine if you had that on. But otherwise, IV antihypertensive would exclude you. And you had to have rails. The doctor had to say they're rails. They had to have a chest x-ray taken and a BNP level or an NT-proBNP level drawn. We needed neither result back. In other words, you could enroll this patient 15 seconds after you saw them if you thought they had heart failure and they met the criteria. So this is going to be a very quickly enrolling trial. Here's what the outcomes were. We had 170 patients were randomized, half were female, about 80% are African American. That's not a function of intention of design. It's because of the centers that we had chosen. Now, what happens is when you do people this early in a trial, some of them will spontaneously get better. As Dr. Pena said, they sit there on the stretcher and their shortness of breath goes away, or their blood pressure goes down because they're calm and they have oxygen on and it's an air-conditioned environment. So of that initial 117, we end up with 104 who actually got study drug. And of that 104, 85 later had a confirmed diagnosis of heart failure. But remember, when you show up acutely, the chest x-ray is not always positive. It may take up to 6 hours for the chest x-ray to show congestion. When we compare the heart failure and the safety population, there is no difference statistically across the board. Not for past medical history, presenting characteristics, labs, or chest x-ray findings. Just to put some numbers behind that, the median BNP is about 650. The ejection fraction median was about 45%. About 27% had a detectable troponin. And the median blood pressure overall is about 180. Our door-to-drug time is there in the right lower quadrant. Standard of care got it in about 2.2 hours. That would be 130 minutes. Clavitipine got it in 2.6 hours. There's no statistical difference between the two. So where this then becomes the earliest enrolling acute heart failure trial ever done. Most standard of care patients got nitroglycerin or nicardipine. About 50% got the nitroglycerin, 30% got nicardipine. There was a group, 13% got a bunch of other things. Remember, this is standard therapy controlled, so doctors did whatever they wanted. So four got isosorbide nitrite, one each got hydralazine, diltiazem, or nitroprusside. When we're going to talk about dyspnea relief in a minute, the dosing becomes real important, so that's here. The clavitipine patients got six milligrams. That's in the middle, that left column there, right there. This is the total dose they got for the entire time they were on it. So go to nitroglycerin. The median dose is 31.7 mics, and people say that's small. Think about VMAC. That was the blinded, controlled, randomized study where one arm had a PA catheter and the other arm didn't, and the average nitroglycerin dose in that trial, if you didn't have a PA catheter, was 35 mics. Docs just don't crank up the nitroglycerin very well. It's the reality. The total dose was, the median was 930 with a range of 400, or median IQR 400 or to 1560. You can see nicardipine 6.3 milligrams with the median total dose of 3.1. This is how blood pressure control went. Clavitipine patients were only a... This is clavitipine in orange, standard of care IV therapy in yellow. And what you can see is this is by 30 minutes, about three-quarters of the clavitipine patients were in the target range and only a third of the standard care patients. This is who needed more drugs than the first drug they got, so rescue therapy. You can see here the clavitipine patients are in orange, and they're only about 15% required a rescue medication. Standard therapy, about half of them ultimately got a rescue medication. This is hours across the bottom. So you can see that they were getting extra therapies added much longer. What happened is about 3 hours into it, most clavitipine patients were done. The question of overshoot, how many people had blood pressures beyond what the doctor requested as the target range occurred in 16 patients on clavitipine. The median overshoot was 8 millimeters of mercury. You can see the IQR here, 6.5 and 13. One standard of care patient overshot, they were 13 millimeters of mercury. So none of these people had death-defying, scary hypertension. There were some overshoots, but they weren't very much. And overall mean time that they were below 90 is 3 minutes for clavitipine and 13 minutes for standard of care. These are adverse events. SAEs occurred in 24% of clavitipine and 19% of standard of care. There's no difference there. There were three deaths in clavitipine, 3% death mortality in clavitipine and 2% in standard of care, but none of these occurred on study drugs. These occurred like 3 or 4 days later. Patients had, these are treatment emergent adverse events. There was one or two in a whole bunch of different categories. The only one that was statistically different between the two was headache that occurred more often in standard of care. But remember, 50% of these people got nitroglycerin, so that's really not much of a surprise. This is the blood pressure effects. You can see that this is standard care in yellow. This is clavitipine in orange. These are minutes across the top, so this is 3 hours. So clavitipine worked much better at reducing blood pressure. And this is the dyspnea score. So we use the 1 to 100 millimeter visual analog score. Look at here is the entry to this. The average dyspnea score was about 65 when they started. And by 2 hours, everybody was getting better. So but what you can see here is the clavitipine patients got much better, and by 3 hours, their dyspnea is almost gone. This is one centimeter on a 10-centimeter scale. This is standard of care. All these asterisks mean statistically different. It took 12 hours for standard of care to get to that point. If you think about other studies that are done that enroll patients at 24 hours over here, this is why a study that enrolls at 24 hours, it's very tough to get an endpoint of dyspnea improvement. Even at 12 hours, it's really tough. And so when you look at the relaxin data at 6 hours, they still have dyspnea improvement opportunities. But the longer you wait, the harder it is to improve dyspnea. The concept here is not all minutes are equal. The early minutes are really valuable. We also looked at the dyspnea relief and blood pressure reductions by the individual agents. This is nitroglycerin. Blue is nicardipine. And yellow and orange is clavitipine. So if you look at nicardipine and clavitipine, they're on top of each other. And you would think their dyspnea scores would be the same. and this was sort of surprising because they weren't. The dyspnea score and the carbidopa is up here versus the dyspnea score with clavidopa is down here, despite the fact they relieve blood pressure, make the number look better. The patient said they felt better significantly. You're looking at a 25 millimeter mercury difference on a dyspnea score between the two drugs. Patients who were in either arm, clavidopa or standard of care, got similar numbers of diagnostic procedures, so chest x-rays and echoes and that sort of thing. Clavidopa patients got no therapeutic procedures, and 17% of standard care did. And those are defined as an ART line, a IV pacer, central lines, defibrillation, going to cath, getting intubated, getting dialyzed, getting blood transfusions, or one guy had a urologic surgery because he had a stricture. We had a number of exploratory endpoints. The bottom line here is clavidopa benefits on every single one of them. But remember, this is an early trial. It's 117 patients. So none of these were powered ahead of time for outcomes, but it's pleasant to see they all move the right way. Sorry. Clavidopa had fewer admissions, fewer ICU admissions, fewer 30-day readmissions. If a 30-day readmission did occur, it occurred about twice as long later than in standard care. They had shorter ICU times, and total hospital length of stay is a day shorter. It's back to that concept of not all minutes are created equal. The early minutes are the important ones. That's where there's value in intervention. This is a pilot study. It's not powered for any of those secondary endpoints. It's an open-label design. I explained that why it's difficult to design to blind a drug that has a one-minute effect and is white when it goes through the IV. And then the question of standard of care, we used the standard of care. The docs did what they wanted to do, but certainly you can criticize the nitroglycerin dosing as being not as aggressive as possible. So in conclusion, this is the earliest enrolling heart failure trial ever performed. Clavidopa resulted in significant, both statistically and clinically significant, reductions in blood pressure and dyspnea. Its safety profile looks similar to the other standard of care medications, and all the secondary endpoints favored clavidopa. And I'd like to say thank you for the opportunity to present this data.
Comments, Mike?
Lately, I've heard a lot about this door-to-needle time. This may be true for some centers, but if you go around the globe and you go to different countries, you'll find out that, let me give you an example. Let's take Romania. When the patient has problems, the ambulance goes home with the doctor, and many cancer patients are being treated at home before they are brought to the hospital. Often, many of those patients are enrolled in those trials. So I'm not sure this concept that may be applicable to maybe U.S. may not be generalizable to each country, that they have different ways of treating patients. So this door to needle time has to be modified based on who those patients are, because sure, it's door to needle time, but the needle actually was minus 24 hours or minus 7 because the patient got the needle before they got to the ED.
Yeah. Adrian, and then Mark.
There's a very interesting data, of course, and it's one concern here. You didn't show anything on renal function, and if you drop the blood pressure very quickly, then probably you would have more patients with worsening renal function, which might be deleterious per se, but also indirectly by less patients that went off the hospital with life-saving therapies. Did you look at serial measurements of renal function and what happened? I predicted more renal dysfunction in the...
Right. Active. So this population starts out, and I didn't go through all the individual characteristics just because there's not enough time to do that, but they start out with about a 50% rate of GFRs that are in the 60 or 90 to range. So the hypertensive heart failure patient seems to have a high level of renal dysfunction. Now, we followed creatinines, and we looked at treatment-emergent adverse events, and there was no difference in standard of care versus clavitipine in terms of renal endpoints. There was one patient in standard of care who ended up on dialysis, and that was it for the whole trial.
And the creatinines themselves, because I'm sure that patient would have developed worsening renal function, because that happens.
So the only way we had of recording that was if the physician caring for the patient indicated that as an adverse event. And so if they didn't tell us there was a bump in the creatinine, we did not. I don't have the data to tell you on day five what the creatinines did. But we only had one report of an adverse renal event.
Mark, it was a very nice presentation and a very interesting approach. And when we start talking about multidisciplinary approach, having emergency room physicians as the front door is really important. But Frank, at the butt, so I'm throwing the butt. Mikhail and everybody's been talking about all different spectrums of heart failure patients. The person who's acutely short of breath, who gives you that elevated blood pressure, which I don't call hypertension, so it's elevated blood pressure at the time, might be a normal tensive person. But someone with an elevated blood pressure is a lower risk than someone with the lower blood pressure. And you have the opportunity to use high doses of diuretics to treat their dyspnea. Do you have any data on the use of diuretics?
Alone?
In your patients.
No, because to get into this trial, you had to have you had to have the intent to treat them with an IV agent. However, there are trials that have done that, head-to-head comparisons of IV versus diuretics with BiPAP, IV diuretics with nitroglycerin. And if you do not give some kind of vasodilator in this elevated blood pressure population, the risk of intubations and adverse events is much higher. That BiPAP alone and diuretics alone did not have a benefit unless there was accompanying vasodilation of some kind. And that's what the other emergency medicine literature shows.
Yeah, but you're doing the opposite, so you're withholding the diuretic. You couldn't give a diuretic?
You were allowed to give diuretics.
So how did people do? How did they treat them?
Everybody got a diuretic plus. Everybody who got a diuretic also got a vasodilator. And while we did not follow urine outputs, there's such a profound decrease in dyspnea scores, and within the first 3 hours it essentially goes away in the clavitipine group. There is very, very few people who have any kind of significant diuresis in that first hour or two. I mean, a lot of diuresis in the first hour would be 100 cc's, and it'd be hard to believe that 100 cc's would account for a 65 millimeter drop or a 55 millimeter drop in your dyspnea score.
John and George.
A great study yet again. I'm going to ask you again, have you got the respiratory rates? Because it would be really nice to see those. And just to remind people that probably actually the fastest recruiting, both in terms of the rate of patient recruitment and also the time from hitting the hospital doors to randomization, is the 3CPO study. So 1,200 patients recruited from UK hospitals alone within a 12-month period and got a result, albeit a neutral result. So it shows that the studies can be done. They can be done efficiently. I think we have very difficult clinical trial designs, which I think that 70 to 80% of trial costs ultimately come back to the issue of blinding. And the question is, do you really need the blinding?
I'd like to add to what you said. First off, I'll fess up, I don't have the respiratory rates. But secondly, but the issue of enrollment. Every one of the centers involved in this trial is we have a group of us that work together in the emergency medicine world, and all of us work with a cardiologist upstairs. And so that we will start the intervention and then hand the patient off, and it's that relationship that makes this kind of studies possible. That if you don't have, if I don't have a cardiologist behind me, what am I going to do with this patient, in 4 hours? And if I don't enroll, they can't get at that patient in 4 hours. So there is a relationship that needs to be within the network of trialists, that if you want to do enrollment early, you're going to have a team. You cannot do it, none of us can do it alone.
We'll get a bunch of Danish colleagues to come
along.
We're going
to Denmark.
Show us how to do it.
George?
So I want to make a couple of comments. I want you to speculate on a couple of things. First of all, this is a predominantly black group that you studied. You used the L-channel CCB. you're going to get vasodilation, not worried about the kidneys at all because they're going to be fine. You didn't drop blood pressure so dramatically. This is not sublingual nifedipine. You got a bit of a diuretic effect from the CCBs. Life is good. And sounds great. That there's an old drug that's a selective dopamine 1 receptor antagonist, phenoldlepam, which would have been phenomenal in these patients. You would have gotten not only what you got, plus a diuretic effect, plus an increase in renal blood flow, plus an increase in GFR. That drug died because of poor business practices. And it's still around. It's not dead, but if you ask most young people training, they never heard of it. It's a problem. So I don't want people walking out of here thinking this is really sexy. I like this. This is very nice. But I guess my question is that if you're looking at this, you've got a predominantly black group that you looked at this. Do you think it would be as good if you looked at it in Caucasians?
Well, so nitrates are supposed to work great in African Americans, and we compared it against nitrates, and it didn't. And to be honest, nitrates got smoked. I think that is somewhat disingenuous in that. The trouble with nitrates is, yeah, they work, and they work in African Americans, but the reality of nitrates is they're a pain to do right. It requires a doctor to stand there at the bedside for half an hour. And I don't know many doctors who are going to do that when you've got a whole practice that's going insane. You know, the guy down the hall just got shot. I got to go deal with that. And you're not so bad. Nitrates at 35, I'm gone. And that doesn't just happen in the ER. It happens in the ICU and the CCU. We're all real doctors with real practices. So this is a population that turned out to be African American. It wasn't our design. Nitrates should have worked on them. I don't think doctors were very aggressive, but clavidipine was really easy, and they got it taken care of.
Mike, but just before, George, maybe you and me, we are going to open a group bringing back old drugs in new trials.
Yeah.
Mike.
So great data. I think it emphasizes the... Well, we talk about a lot, but this heterogeneity in different populations. So, I mean, I talked about stage A, stage B, stage C. You really almost have stage A minus or Z, whatever, up. You're really looking at a hyperacute trial. And almost all your patients had hypertension and pulmonary edema, like they had rails to get in. And it's interesting. So what you have there is a population that's highly symptomatic. They can't breathe at all, but they get better often quite quickly, and their downstream risk is fairly low, at least. So you're almost looking at a symptomatic treatment, like what can I do to make this person feel better faster? And as you think about different trials and different drugs, you know, there's a slightly downstream population who don't get immediately better in the emergency room and get hospitalized. And those are the people who have the more prolonged. So if you look at trials, you had VAS scores already down in the 20s, after a few hours, and so when we see the more subacute population, they still have VAS scores that are higher days later. So I think it's a great example of targeting. You have a drug and you know what it's going to do, and targeting a very specific population where you think it's likely to have effect. And there's going to be space for all these different interventions in different populations, just like there's all different antibiotics for different infections.
Yeah, I think the blood pressure is an easy and quick way to risk stratify these patients. The higher the blood pressure, the lower the risk the patient is, really. I don't know what if 160, we picked 160 because we knew we could have an effect there. Could we have gone to 140? If you get to 140, it's 50% of all heart failure present to the hospital. And lowered them, and would they have gotten better? And that's a question for another study. And if you go down to 90, you're down to the last 2%, and that's a whole different animal. They're here for a month.
Mike, you're a big star. There are still many questions, but we're going to stop after Rob, Mihai, and yep. Ileana.
Frank, in terms of previous history, do you know how many of these patients had a history of hypertension?
Yeah, like 80%.
Right. So this is in follow-up to Mark's comment. So Mark, with a blood pressure of 160 and 80% with a history of hypertension, you still don't consider this hypertensive heart failure? Or?
No, I just said you can't use a blood pressure at the time somebody's acutely in distress to say they're hypertensive.
All right.
Now he's saying 80% of them also were hypertensive.
Yeah.
I was just not using that one blood pressure.
Yeah, but that together with the history.
Yeah.
Okay. To make that fair, though, we didn't take their history ahead of time. These people are so symptomatic. You don't ask them, got a history of hypertension? It's like, oh, do I have to intubate you or not? it's very hard to even obtain IRB consent on these people because they're so short of breath. And if you look at other studies with the similar entry criteria that have been done in the emergency department, 27% of them get intubated. They end up in the ICU on a ventilator. So the one advantage that we got out of this is that only one person in this entire study got intubated. So we avoided the ICU right there. And then when they're breathing better, you can ask them, hey, if you have a history of hypertension, what are your medicines, by the way? And do you got any allergies? Because at first, you're just putting out the fire.
I cannot overemphasize what Mark Pfeffer just said. Most of the hypertension is reactive. When you have a high sympathetic tone, when the wedge is sturdy and you have difficulty in breathing, the blood pressure is high. And the optimized HF, patients with a blood pressure above 160, within few hours, normalize their blood pressure once they got a diuretic. So we have to distinguish between maybe the black population, maybe we have to distinguish between the minority of patients that have the so-called acute heart failure because of high blood pressure and those patients in whom the blood pressure is related to high sympathetic tone that will respond within hours. If you look at our optimized HF data, within hours, and normalizing the blood pressure. And it's a very easy way to distinguish between the two. The group that has reactive hypertension, you give them a diuretic, and within 2 hours, when they are breathing better, the blood pressure is normal. Compared to the group where the hypertension is causing the problem, you can give one or two or three or four diuretics, will not do. But usually those patients have much higher blood pressure, and again, they will not respond to a diuretic. But most patients who are hypertensive, I agree with Mark Pfeffer, have reactive hypertension related to high sympathetic tone and high feeling pressure.
Just a comment there. You could take a normal subject and maximally exercise them. It would be very difficult to get their systolic blood pressure off of 180. This data has been published for years. And so that would be like saying all normals, where these were not hypertensives, these could have just been hyperreactors, but they were hyperreacting at a level of maximal exercise. First of all, I'm not discounting that. I mean, I think that could happen. But if you're talking about heart failure patients who otherwise, you know, don't have hypertension, to get them to a systolic of 180 before they had to stop exercise would be virtually impossible.
Ileana?
So we all agree that being in the hospital is bad for you. You get hospitalized with heart failure, your mortality is high. And we all know about early administration of whatever you're going to give them. What we haven't ever really talked about is, are there patients that you can treat and send home? So looking at our own data where I am, 93% of the patients come in through the ED. So I agree with you about a good partnership with your ED docs. 93% of those get admitted. And yet I believe that there are patients that you can safely treat, send out, and see within 48 hours. And that may be a very different population than, you know, we look at these trials and we see all this heterogeneity, and some patients do very well and some don't. Well, some patients probably don't need to be hospitalized. And we've been seeing those in our clinics and in our offices for years that we treat in our office and we get them home. We see them back again the next day. And we don't know what the outcome is of those folks. We only know them when they come in the hospital where bad things happen, like drugs get taken away and, you know, we give them other stuff and they get infected. And what about that group? We've never studied them. Not really.
So what you're talking about is low-risk predictors. High-risk predictors are something bad's going to happen. You know, your troponin's elevated or you present with a BUN of 55. We know those people do terribly. The converse is the absence of high-risk predictors doesn't mean you're low-risk. And we've actually looked at this in about 600 patients on what are the low-risk predictors, who can go home within 24 hours and it will be alive and well in 30 days and not come back ever for a readmission. And we were only able to find two things, and one was a blood pressure greater than 160 and a negative troponin. And so those people who predict, who present very hypertensive, that's a predictor of doing well if you can get them tuned up, watch them for 24 hours, and they go home. And they don't come back for the next 30 days. Those are the two low-risk predictors that we've established.
But see, I propose seeing those people at 48 hours, not waiting. And I would call them the wet and the warm, you know, in the Lynn Stevenson. Their cardiac outputs are okay, and they're wet for whatever reason. They stopped their drugs, or they ate too much sodium, whatever it is that brought them in. You can take care of them and get them out. And maybe their survival is very different in 60 days or in 90 days.
So
I mean, I'd love to hear some comments.
When we put together our option, that was the perfect person that'd go in it. They would be there overnight. They would go home the next morning. That was 35% of our heart failure emergency department population. Never saw the hospital. They got came in, tuned, and gone.
Question from the floor. I'm trying to get in here.
Oh, hey, Allison.
Hi. I'm sorry. I may have misunderstood something because I was waiting for someone else to comment and no one has. So no problem with open label studies, no problem with subjective endpoints, but you've talked a lot about dyspnea score in an open label study, that combination of open label and a subjective endpoint. Comments?
Well, the question is, how are we else going to evaluate dyspnea? We wanted to have a patient-centered outcome. That's where we were trying to go with this. And short of dyspnea, asking them how they are, the other scores, you know, the visual analog score is the one score that seems to consistently demonstrate improvement. It's not really well validated. I've looked at the pain literature, which validates pain scores between. And if you're greater than 13 millimeters difference on a visual analog pain score, then that's considered clinically significant. But
no problem with that. Why not blind it?
So why didn't we blind this? And the reason is as I explained, it's a white. It looks like intralipid. If you have to titrate it every 3 minutes, it has a drug effect within 60 seconds. It's obvious that you've got something that you didn't, you know, if you go against nitroglycerin, I promise you that nitroglycerin doesn't come anywhere to acting like that. You could use nipride as the only other drug that does that, but nipride is so much of a problem in terms of lability. I mean, you go from 180 to 60 in 5 minutes, and so nipride is a scary drug in these really unstable patients. So either it becomes clinically very obvious that you're using a drug that's not like the other ones. And even if you got past those titration issues and clinical response issues, you know, if you're using intralipid as a blinded cohort, your placebo, even that becomes obvious in their blood tests. So we rolled around with this for hours trying to figure out what is the best way to blind this.
Sure, no problem. But, I mean, we are at a trialist workshop, and these kind of clinical design issues are what everyone struggles with all the time. And I would say one has to then figure out some very, very complex way to blind, or someone has to look for a endpoint that cannot be influenced by the lack of blinding, is all I'm
Maybe the independent have an independent assessment that can't tell what has happened in that early stages, but this is a good point, and
yeah.
And it really leads up to our, if I can move us on, because Alex, our co-chairman, is going to be talking about dyspnea endpoints, and we'll keep leading this discussion
session. Could I have a brief comment on blinding? I mean, people, if you have worked with clinical trials, blinding requires a separate team to mix the medication and hand it over to those that are going to use it. So if you have to call a phone and you have to call a team, blinding will take you at least 2 hours in clinical practice. So if you want to be early on with your treatment, it cannot be combined with blinding. It's impossible from a practical perspective.
It's very difficult, at least. Thank you very much.